Surveillance video is being shown in a quiet Sumner County courtroom in Gallatin, Tennessee. In the video, a 29-year-old man wearing a white t-shirt, gray sweatpants, and a backwards baseball hat is walking through the kitchen of his home, his left hand up to his ear as he talks on his cell phone. The next clip shows the living room, where the man continues to hold his phone up to his left ear as he makes his way through the living room, down the hallway, towards his bedroom. The prosecutor, an older man who speaks slowly and deliberately, pauses the video, and the still image of the man talking on his phone is frozen on the screen. David Harrell, a police officer with the Hendersonville Police Department, is sitting on the stand. He speaks into the microphone and uses a pointer to point at a black object that can be seen in the man's right hand. Some of the jurors lean forward in their seats. The man is holding what looks like a handgun. The next video is again of the kitchen area. This time, there's an 11-year-old girl walking through the kitchen, just coming home from school, a backpack strapped to her back. Another clip shows the living room again, and the little girl can be seen at the far left of the screen, almost out of the camera's view. Officer Harrell then describes what could be confusing to just a casual observer. He explains that the image of the girl suddenly jumps back and is thrust out of the view of the camera. The man we saw before then runs into the room, picks the girl up in his arms, and runs out. In the courtroom, that same man sits at the defense table, wiping what looks like tears from his eyes. He's on trial for the reckless homicide of his 11-year-old daughter. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 44. Hey everyone, I hope you all had a wonderful holiday and got lots of good presents, spent time with loved ones, or just did whatever it is that makes you happy. I'm happy to say that Court Junkie is back from my holiday break, and I'm ready to get into more trials, criminal cases, and deep dives into the justice system. Hope you guys are ready. Today's case was suggested by a listener. And as always, if you have a case you'd like to hear, you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com and let me know. But in today's case, we'll be going over the tragic death of an 11-year-old girl and the consequences for the man who killed her. Both the prosecution and the defense in this case acknowledge that the intent was not to kill, but they disagree on what the charges and what the outcome should be. And after listening to everything I'm going to tell you about this case, I want to know what you think about it. It all started on August 8th, 2016, at almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when 29-year-old Timothy Batts ran into the Hendersonville Medical Center in Hendersonville, Tennessee, cradling his 11-year-old daughter, Tamia, in his arms. She had been shot in the stomach. It's customary that anytime someone comes to a hospital with a gunshot wound, for the hospital to then call the police. So just a short time later, an officer from the Hendersonville Police Department arrived. After being briefed by one of the doctors, Officer Ryan Brooks headed to the waiting area where he was told Tamia's father would be. Officer Brooks spotted the man wearing a white blood-stained t-shirt, dark shorts, and Nike tennis shoes. He walked over and asked him what had happened. Timothy told him that he had been asleep inside his house when he was awoken by Tamia coming into the house after school, screaming that she had been shot. He said he saw her holding her abdomen and that there was blood gushing from the wound, and so he picked her up and rushed her to the hospital. But the more Timothy talked about what happened, the more his story didn't really make sense to Officer Brooks. He asked Timothy to re-summarize what had happened, and this time, Timothy told him that he had been awake, not asleep, and he offered more information, saying that he believed that Tamia had been shot after she had gotten off the school bus that day. Timothy added that there were no guns or other weapons in their home, and Officer Brooks couldn't help but notice that Timothy had offered that information unprompted. Tamia was transferred by helicopter to Vanderbilt University Medical Center, but she died from her injuries just 2 hours later. After speaking with Timothy, Officer Brooks radioed other responding units and instructed them to go to the Batts residence to set up a perimeter. At that point, he had nothing to go off of aside from Timothy's story that someone may have shot Tamia as she was getting off the school bus. Officers descended upon the Batts home and started doing a canvas of the neighborhood, asking neighbors and residents what they had seen and heard. No one reported hearing any gunfire, and no one had any information. But the officers also got a search warrant for the Batts home at 118 Shady View Drive, and a crime scene unit carefully combed through the house, looking for any evidence of blood or any evidence that the shooting may have taken place inside the home. And indeed, they found a bullet hole in a wall in the living room and blood spatter on the walls. There was also a .40 caliber shell casing in the master bedroom, which meant that Timothy wasn't telling the truth about what happened. A few hours later, much to the police department's surprise, Timothy, his stepfather, his pastor, and some other family members came into the police department and said that they wanted to speak with detectives. Timothy told them that he wanted to come clean and tell the truth. He told them that it had all been a tragic accident, that he hadn't meant to shoot her, but he did. He had killed his own daughter. He said he had surveillance cameras in the house and that everything would be on the video. He said he had removed the gun, which was his cousin's, from the home and that it was now in Nashville. Timothy was charged with reckless homicide, tampering with evidence, and possessing a firearm as a felon. But his charges were made even worse due to the fact that Timothy was known to police. You see, Timothy had a prior felony conviction for drug possession from his late teenage years. And since Timothy was a convicted felon, he wasn't allowed by law to be in possession of a gun. And yet here he was, facing one of the most serious charges, which included the use of a gun. And not only that, but Timothy had quite a dangerous past, too. In early 2011, Timothy survived being shot 6 times outside of a barbershop. The man who shot him received a 10-year prison sentence for attempted second-degree murder, but was out on probation about a year later. In February 2012, police in Nashville, Tennessee, sent out a press release stating that they had issued an arrest warrant against Timothy, who was then 24, for allegedly firing shots from a rear passenger seat of an SUV at the driver of another vehicle. And the man he was allegedly shooting at? None other than the man who had shot him about a year prior. The man was shot in the shoulder, but escaped any serious injury. That case never went anywhere, however, and it's hard to figure out why. It may have been dismissed. There's no record of it having proceeded anywhere, and when asked by reporters, Nashville police stated that they were no longer looking for Timothy. Just one day after Tamia's death, Timothy was booked into the Sumner County Jail and was shortly released on a $500,000 bond. Yet just 3 days later, Timothy failed a drug test and his bond was revoked. He was wearing a necklace with Tamia's photo on it as he was taken back into custody to await his trial. Going into Timothy's trial, it was clear that this wasn't a cut and dry case. Sure, you already knew who was responsible for Tamia's death going into it, but sometimes things are not that simple, especially legally speaking. Some people might believe that what happened to Tamia was intentional, while some, including the prosecutors, believed that it was a tragic, though reckless act on Timothy's part. But even reckless acts sometimes have criminal consequences in our justice system. And in this case, a little girl lost her life to something that could have been prevented. So the question would be, what sort of punishment, if any, was the right one in a case like this? Opening statements began in July 2017. Sumner County District Attorney Ray Whitley described Tamia's last day alive. He said that on August 8th, 2016, Tamia went to her first day of sixth grade at a new school. After the school day was finished, she got off the bus and got home at 2:49 p.m. 5 minutes before that, at 2:44 p.m., Timothy was walking around inside his house, talking on his cell phone and holding a gun. And just 6 minutes later, at 2:50 p.m., Timothy shot Tamia with a .40 caliber gun. How do we know that just minutes prior to Tamia coming home, that Timothy was walking around the house with his cell phone and a handgun? Prosecutor Whitley asked. Because Timothy had two security cameras inside the house. And those cameras capture him shooting her, picking her up in his arms, and rushing out of the house with her. Whitley said that the state will prove that after he shot her, he did not tell the truth about what had happened. He concealed his firearm that he shouldn't have had in the first place. He told police that she came into the home and was holding herself and that she had already been shot. And then, Whitley said, he sent the police on a wild goose chase looking for who could have shot her when she got off the bus. When really, she had been shot inside of the home by her own father. Timothy lied to not only the police, but to doctors at the hospital. Prosecutor Whitley conceded that they have no proof at all that Timothy intended to kill Tamia. If that were the case, he would be charged with murder. But instead, he said, it's a reckless homicide case. Proof will show that Timothy recklessly pulled the trigger and shot and killed his own daughter. In his opening statements, one of Timothy's defense attorneys, Derek Scretchen, told the jury what Timothy was like as a person and described how he had turned his life around. He said Timothy married his high school sweetheart and that they had Tamia in July 2005. A year later, in July 2006, they had another little girl named Tamia. Timothy was 19 years old at the time. He had two kids and was in a relationship with their mother. In 2008, they had a third child, Sanya. So there Timothy was, Scretchen said, in his early 20s with three daughters, trying to find a job. His relationship with the children's mother began to deteriorate, and so they shared custody. Scretchen said Timothy was crazy about his little girls, and that Tamia was the oldest, his namesake. Timothy never finished high school, but did get his GED. At the age of 18, he pleaded guilty to attempting to possess drugs, which is the current felony on his record. He went to court to try and get custody of his daughters, and after a contentious court battle, he won. He started dating a woman named Jasmine, who is his current fiance. They then had a son together. So by the age of 25, Timothy had custody of all four of his kids. He had a lawn care business and also cut hair. His fiance went to school in Nashville. On the day Tamia died, Scretchen said that it was a tragic accident and that Timothy hadn't meant to shoot and kill his daughter. That after Timothy had pulled the trigger and shot her, he dropped the gun, picked Tamia up, and said, "What have I done?" Scretchen then described what happened next, saying that Timothy ran into the garage and placed Tamia into his car. He then ran back inside.
He gets his keys, he gets his shoes, and he picks up the gun, runs to the car. He's 2 minutes away from Hendersonville Medical Center. They drive to Hendersonville Medical Center, and you can just imagine what that drive had to be like. He's crying, he's apologizing. She's, "Daddy, I understand. I don't think you did it on purpose." They get to the hospital. "I need help. Somebody help me." Hospital personnel, they come out and they end up putting Tamia into a wheelchair. And at some point, somebody must have attempted to soothe Mr. Bass because they said, "She's going to be fine. She's going to be okay." So they wheel her away in the wheelchair. What he doesn't know, Mr. Bass, as he's looking at her, this is going to be the last time that he ever sees her alive.
Scretchen conceded that when police got to the hospital, Timothy lied to them.
So Officer Brooks approaches him with the intent to investigate, to ask questions, and he asks him, "What happened?" Now, once again, you got to know what's going through his mind at that time. And he did. He's a convicted felon. He's not supposed to have that gun. And so he's saying, if I tell this officer that I have this gun, that I had this gun, and see, understand, he doesn't know that his daughter's going to pass. He doesn't know that she's going to die. They've told him everything's going to be okay. He knows that if he tells this officer that I've got this gun, he's going to jail immediately. He's going to jail. His daughter will be treated. It doesn't matter if she needs a blood transfusion. It doesn't matter what he won't be there for. He won't be there to provide anything she can need. He'll be somewhere else. So what does he tell the officer? The officer asks him what happened. And no, he did not tell him he shot Tamia then. And he said, I'm laying down. She comes in. She had been shot. And it must have been sometime outside. And yes, he told them I did not have a gun.
Scrutchen said that after Tamia passed away, Timothy decided to voluntarily go into the police station and tell the truth. He told them about the surveillance video in the home and where they could find the gun. Scrutchen concluded by telling the jury that Timothy was not legally responsible for the death of Tamia. The prosecution's first witness was Officer Ryan Brooks, who described responding to the Hendersonville Medical Center at about 2:57 p.m. on August 8, 2016. He said the call that had been dispatched to him described a female juvenile who had been taken to the hospital with a gunshot wound to her abdomen area. He told the jury about Timothy's conflicting statements upon first talking to him, that Timothy had first told him that he had been asleep and then said that he was awake when Tamia came home. By the time he made it over to the Batts home later that day, detectives there had already figured out that the incident had taken place inside the home and that Timothy's story had been a lie. Hendersonville Police Detective Christopher Gagnon testified that he responded to Vanderbilt University Medical Center after Tamia had been transferred there at about 4 p.m. He spoke to Timothy in the security office, trying to get an idea of exactly what had happened. He said other family members were there at the time, including Tamia's mother.
How long did you get the chance to talk to Mr. Batts?
It was just a short time. I sat down to try to get an idea of exactly what happened because I went up there blind to everything that had gone on. And I talked with him long enough to determine that he did not know what had happened, and then the social worker came and retrieved him and the mother to take them back to the back.
So you say you determined that he did not know what happened. What did he explain to you?
He said that Tamia had come into the house and she said, "Daddy, Daddy," and he looked at her and she had blood coming from the front of her. He scooped her up and took her to the ER. I asked where she had gotten off the bus at, and he wasn't able to tell me. Asked him what time she was supposed to be getting home. He said he didn't know. I asked, who she would have gotten off the bus with. He said he didn't know. He said it was her first day at Knox Doss, so everything was new. And then, but he inferred that whatever the incident was, that it happened outside and he hadn't heard anything inside the house.
Did he explain to you what he was doing when Tamia came in saying, "Daddy, Daddy"?
He said he was laying down.
Detective Gagnon said a social worker came in and told them that they were doing CPR on Tamia and that she was going to take Timothy and Tamia's mother back there with her. Tamia passed away a short time later, and Tamia's mother was very upset. He said he didn't see Timothy's reaction, but described him as, quote, straight-faced whenever he saw him after that. He said he heard that there had been an issue between Timothy and Tamia's mother, and that as a result, Timothy ended up leaving the hospital. None of the family members were able to get in touch with him, but Timothy's stepfather told Detective Gagnon that he would have Timothy contact him. Detective Gagnon said that he stood with Tamia as the rest of her family came in pairs of two, to see her and say their goodbyes. He said he then sat with her until her body was moved to the morgue. Several hours later, Timothy, his stepfather, his pastor, and some family members came into the police station. Detective Gagnon said that Detective Harris was the one who spoke with them. But his involvement in the case continued after Timothy's cousin, who had come in with Timothy to the police station, led him and another officer to a Waffle House to retrieve a .40-caliber Glock from a man named Charles Bradley. He said the gun was wrapped inside of a towel with the magazine taken out. He took the gun back to the police department and logged it into evidence. Detective David Harrell took the stand while the surveillance video from the Batts home was played in court. Timothy sobbed at the defense table as the images showed himself walking through the home, talking on his phone and holding a gun in his right hand. And then minutes later, as Tamia walked through the kitchen, her backpack strapped to her back. A sudden jolt and Tamia was thrust back, falling out of view of the camera. Detective Harrell testified that he took photographs of Timothy's vehicle. There was blood inside the car, consistent with Tamia having been inside of there, and he said that there were a couple dollar bills in the center console. Detective Sean Sims testified about the initial searches done at the Batts home after Tamia's death. He said at first they thought that she had been shot as she was getting off the school bus, and so they found the bus driver and interviewed her. The driver said that two other kids got off the bus with Tamia and that she remembered seeing a white SUV and another child in the area. Detective Sims followed those leads, but nothing came of them. At the Batts home, in addition to the evidence of a shooting that detectives found, they also discovered cash in the pocket of a coat hanging in the bedroom closet, totaling $6,270. Detective Sims said that later that day, he was informed that there was a gun box located under a dresser in the master bedroom that he had not found in the initial search of the home. He said inside the gun box was a barrel for a gun, two magazines, and a small envelope with ammunition. We'll get into more testimony, including testimony from additional detectives, and then we'll get into the defense's case right after this quick break from our sponsor. Okay, everyone, I have a new favorite mattress company that I can wholeheartedly recommend as a wonderful option if you're in the market for a new mattress. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. And if that makes you all warm and fuzzy inside, the mattress itself is wonderful too. With a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including a 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, a 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startups to watch. So, how do you get your hands on one? Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. It's available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City, and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. And better yet, there's an exclusive offer for you court junkies. Get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. That's $100 off. Just go to leesa.com/junkie. This episode is also sponsored by Everlywell, a company I am super excited to get behind. Let's be real. Going to the doctor is terrible, and finding time to get important lab tests done is almost impossible. Plus, the process is tedious and expensive. But now you can complete your testing from the comfort of home thanks to Everlywell. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of tests, ranging from food sensitivity to metabolism to cholesterol. The tests are private, simple, and all processed through certified labs. All you have to do is head to everlywell.com, choose your tests, and they'll be shipped directly to your doorstep. Then, once you complete your sample collection and send it back into Everlywell's certified labs, they will process your sample and send you your results via Everlywell's secure online platform. I got the food sensitivity test, metabolism test, and the sleep and stress test, and I'm super excited to try these out. No more sitting in waiting rooms for hours. Head to everlywell.com and use code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Again, head to everlywell.com and use offer code JUNKIE for 15% off your first order. Take control of your health today with Everlywell's at-home health tests. Your tests, your time, your terms. A man named Tyson Moser, a maintenance worker and security assistant at the Hendersonville Medical Center, took the stand and testified that he was asked to move Timothy's vehicle on August 8, 2016, because it was blocking the emergency room entrance. He said he saw a large sum of money in one of the cup holders in the center console. The outside of the bills were $100 bills, and he said that they filled the entire cup holder. He said later, he saw Timothy and a couple other people running over to the car and leaving in it. Deputy Neil Harris testified about the interview he did with Timothy after Timothy came into the police station with his family, saying that he wanted to talk to them. He said he was surprised that Timothy had showed up like that. Timothy told him that it had all been an accident and that there were cameras in the house that would show that. He then agreed to write a statement detailing what had happened. Deputy Harris read the statement out loud in court.
Says, I went home around 2:30, was about to take a nap before my kids came from school. I was dozing off and I heard a noise coming from the living room. So I jumped up like, who's in there? Nobody said a word. So I thought someone was breaking in the house. I grabbed the gun, got up to see who was there, walked toward the living room, and my daughter jumped out and said, and I'm sorry, I can't read. There's a word in quotes right there that I can't read. Whatever word that is. I fired a shot before seeing who it was, and when I noticed it was her, I grabbed her and went straight to the ER.
Timothy told Deputy Harris that he gave his cousin the gun and agreed to have him turn it over to the police. Deputy Harris also asked Timothy about the money that Tyson Moser had seen in the center console of his car.
I asked him about the money that was in the console in the car.
What was his response when you asked him about the money?
I told him that we had learned that there had been a substantial amount of money in the center console cup hole area of the car. And he told me that there wasn't. And I said, well, you know, they're saying there was. And he says, well, it couldn't have been more than just a couple dollars. And pulled money out of his pocket and said that the money in his pocket is what he got from the car. What he pulled out of his pocket was just a couple bills. It wasn't consistent with what had been described to me.
Is that your only conversation about money?
I asked him about the money in his house that had been recovered during a search warrant. And he told me that it was his money, that he doesn't use banks, that he collects money from booth rent, that he has some type of salon or something like that.
That
he said he collects money from booth rent, that he owns some kind of salon.
Can you please spell that?
Booth?
Booth?
Yes, like a booth at a salon or a barbershop. Yeah.
Deputy Harris said that Timothy was very concerned about whether he was going to be arrested and would have to go to jail. Harris told him that he wasn't sure yet about the charges, but read him his rights. The prosecution closed their case with testimony from Dr. David Zimmerman, the forensic pathologist who performed the autopsy on Tamia. He testified that the cause of death was a gunshot wound to the abdomen and said that other than the bullet wound, Tamia was a healthy young girl. The defense first presented a character witness, a man named David Hyland, who was a professional master barber, an instructor at a city barber college in East Nashville. He testified that Timothy had recently completed his barber course and was about to graduate. He said that Timothy was a great student, that his customer service skills were impeccable, and also said that this sort of business can also be a cash business. Timothy Batts then took the stand in his own defense. By now, Timothy was 30 years old, and he recounted for the jury how he had been convicted of a felony when he was 18. He said he was convicted of attempting to possess under 5 grams for resale of cocaine. He said he has had no drug charges since that arrest. He told the court that he has had full custody of his children for the last 5 years, but that he had always been in their lives. He said he and his fiancée, Jasmine, had been living at 118 Shadyview Drive for the last 2.5 years. He testified that he was self-employed, that he made money from the lawn service and from a barber salon he had. He and Jasmine had been saving up money to buy a house. He stated that on the Saturday before the incident, his cousin came over. They had been planning on going to a gun range, but ended up drinking instead. He said his cousin asked if he could leave the gun in a gun box at Timothy's house because he had been drinking and didn't want to drive with it. So Timothy said he put the gun under the dresser in his room. On August 8th, he said he had the gun with him that day because Jasmine had told him that she didn't want it in the house anymore. He then described for the jury, in his own words, what happened.
Tell me what happened.
As I was coming in the house.
Tell the jury what happened.
I came back home. You know, I was trying to get home in time before my kids get there because this was Tamia's first day at the new school, so I wanted to learn her time. But at the same time, I wanted to come in and try to doze off, give me a little nap before they got there. So once I came in the house through the garage and went straight to my bedroom, and I put the gun up under the dresser where it was at. So I laid in the bed and tried to doze off once I got off the phone. And as I'm dozing off, I'm laying there, and I hear a noise that say, doom, doom. So I wasn't in that deep of a sleep, so I jumped up. I'm like, who is that? Who's in there? And, you know, I'm like, who is that? And, like, nobody saying a word. So, man, that's when I had got up out the bed. Well, I didn't get up until I seen a shadow come across the door. So I knew somebody was in there. And I had just got there, so I'm like, I'm thinking maybe somebody was already in the house. So that's when I had jumped up and I had grabbed a gun. And as I'm creeping around the corner, I'm still like, who is it? Who in there? And then it's like a small hallway with a closet in between my bedroom and the living room. And as I'm making it through the hallway, coming into the living room, at the edge of the door, she jumped out from the side of the wall and say, "Wow!" And, you know, as if to scare me. And the gun was in my hand and it just went off. And I realized it was Tamir. I'm like, Tamir, please tell me you're not here. And so we both, like, it hurt me to see that it was her. So I grabbed her immediately, ran out of the house, put her in the car. And when I got to the car, I didn't have on no shoes or didn't have the keys to even start the car. So I ran back in the house and grabbed it. And I ran back and grabbed it and came to the car and went straight to Hendersonville Medical Center.
Timothy said he had no idea that what he had heard was his daughter, that he was used to his kids coming home after 4 p.m., but that this was a new school for Tamia.
Now, you said that you believed or thought someone was already in there. Who did you think that someone was?
I had no idea. I thought maybe it was somebody breaking into the house.
Okay, so you thought it was an intruder. Did you think it was your child?
No, I had no idea. Never would have thought that.
Why did you not think it was your child?
Because to my knowledge, she was at school, and, you know, I wasn't thinking that she would be there yet, because it was still around 2-something when I got home.
Okay. All right. And you say you had yelled out.
Yes, ma'am.
And what did you say?
I'm like, who's there? Who in there?
Okay.
Because I knew somebody was in there, because I seen a shadow come across my bedroom door. It was open.
Okay. And did you see that after you had called out?
Yeah, after I had called out.
Okay. Okay, so you said you had come in, you had gone to your bedroom, and you, is it after the shadow, you say it's after the shadow that you grabbed the gun. Is that right?
You said after I had was seen.
I'm sorry. When do you grab the gun? Is it after you call out?
After I seen the shadow go across the door.
Okay, so you're sure after you see this shadow?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, is that because you feel sure then there's an intruder?
Because I knew for a fact that somebody was there after I seen the shadow come across the door.
Okay, and who did you think that someone?
I had no idea who I thought it was an intruder, somebody breaking in the house.
Okay, so you felt certain that this is someone that does not belong there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Timothy's defense attorney, Joy Kimbrough, questioned why Timothy came back in for the gun after placing Tamia inside the car.
You said you immediately took Tamia to the car.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And you said you came back in for your keys and your shoes.
Yes, ma'am.
You couldn't leave without your keys.
No, ma'am.
Okay. So Tamia's in the car and we see you running in. You grabbing your keys and your shoes. Where's the gun at that time?
I really, honestly, I don't know. I don't know where it was. Maybe it was in my pocket. I'm not sure.
You don't remember if the gun, if you picked it up or if you just, you don't know?
No, ma'am.
But you have it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. You have the gun mm-hmm. when you run out?
Yes, ma'am.
Timothy testified that he called Tamia's mother right away, and then Jasmine and his mother. He got to the hospital and jumped out of the car and started screaming, "Help me." The hospital staff ran out and took Tamia away in a wheelchair. He said they stopped him and told him that he needed to wait in the waiting room. He said he stayed at Hendersonville until he was told that she was being airlifted to Vanderbilt. His sister then drove him, his mother, and stepfather there. When they got to Vanderbilt, Timothy went to the emergency room, and they told him that she wasn't there yet. In the meantime, another officer who had arrived asked to speak with him. By this time, he said there were about 20 family members there. While he was speaking with the officer, the hospital staff called him and Tamia's mother over, and about 15 minutes later, they were told that Tamia hadn't made it. He said both he and Tamia's mom broke down. He said he eventually left with one of his cousins after he saw how emotional Tamia's mom was getting with him, banging on his chest and asking what had happened. He said as he was leaving the hospital, he, quote, wanted to just kill himself. At this time, he testified that the gun was in the car under the seat. He said he had put it there after putting Tamia inside the car. He then described for the jury Tamia's last moments with him, in the car on the way to the hospital.
On the drive over from the house to Hendersonville Hospital, when it's just you and Tamia in the car, is she unconscious? What's going on then?
Well, we was talking, and, you know, Tamia.
So she was not unconscious?
No, ma'am.
How was she then when she's in the car?
We was realizing what was going on, and you asking what was she saying.
So you all were talking?
Yes, ma'am.
So she was able to talk?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and was she like in her right mind? Could she?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you all are having a conversation. You driving, she's on the passenger. What are you all saying?
And we both was crying, and I was just apologizing so much, telling her how sorry I was and letting her know to me I didn't mean to do this. You know, I would never do anything to hurt you. And she was like, Daddy, just tell me this a dream. Daddy, tell me it's a dream. And then I was like, you know, I just kept on telling her, I'm sorry to me, I'm sorry. And then she was like, I know. She like, I know it. And then, you know, I can't remember there was much of that right there. And about before it was over, we were pulling up in Hendersonville.
Okay. All right. Timothy
said he decided that he wanted to tell the police the truth, even if that meant that he would have to miss Tamia's funeral.
I feel like I needed to go. I talked to the detectives and let them know the full truth and everything that happened that day.
Okay. Why now do you feel like telling the truth?
Because Tamia, everything that happened, you know, it had already happened and Tamia was gone, and I didn't want, you know, to be looking like a murderer, you know, like I did this to my daughter intentionally. So I feel like that I had to go talk to these detectives and tell them what really happened.
And did you not mind going down there without a lawyer? You didn't mind just going and spilling your guts?
No, ma'am. I knew I needed to.
Okay, you needed to.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So you go to the station. And is your family with you then?
Yes, ma'am.
Who drives you to the station?
I can't remember who I was in the car with, but somebody drove, but I know it was about four or five of us in the car.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Now, your cousin that owned the gun, was he at the house, at your mother-in-law's house?
Yes, ma'am. He had came over there.
He was over there, too?
Yes, ma'am.
Does he also go down to the police station?
Yes, ma'am.
So everybody goes?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. You go down to the police station, and what do you say?
And I go in there, and I told them that I was here to talk to them, and I told them that I wanted to just be honest with them and tell them the whole truth, everything that happened that day. And I told them what I had told them in Hendersonville, just letting them know that I wanted to be there. And he was like, I totally understand.
Did you know that when you went down there and said that, that you may be arrested?
I knew, I didn't know, but I figured I would be.
Okay, and you did that even though you knew you may be arrested and may miss the funeral of your child, the burial of your child? Even with all that in mind, you wanted to go tell the truth?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Mr. Bass, did you ever think for 1 second, 1 minute, at all, when you were shooting, that could have been your daughter?
I never thought that. I never would have thought that.
All right. Okay, I have no further questions, Your Honor.
On cross-examination, the prosecutor pointed out that Tamia was 4 feet, 8 inches tall, and Timothy was 6 feet tall. Prosecutor Whitley asked why there were even security cameras in the house in the first place, if it was because he was concerned that someone would come in and try to take his money. Timothy said no, that they were there for safety concerns. When asked why Timothy had lied to the police and to the doctors about what had happened, Timothy said he had wanted to make sure that he was there for Tamia, that she was still alive at that time. But after explaining that he had his cousin's gun on him because Jasmine didn't want it in the house, he agreed with Prosecutor Whitley that it would have been safer inside the lockbox under the dresser. During closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Katie Walker pointed out that at 3 p.m., when Timothy was expecting his children home from school, he grabbed his gun instead. That he said he had fired his gun without looking to see who it was. Walker told the jury that it could have been any one of his four children, and she called his actions reckless. Was it an accident, or was his mind on something else when it should have been on his kids? She asked. She brought up the cash that Tyson Moser had seen in Timothy's car and said that that cash was gone when Timothy turned his car over to the police. She said the Batts home had bars on the front and back doors and video cameras recording. She told the jury to look closely at one of the surveillance videos and said that in one of them, you could see Timothy looking over his shoulder. She said his mind was clearly on something else. She then compared the case to a DUI.
During jury questioning, defense counsel suggested that this was kind of like driving without a license. You're in your car, you don't have a license, you're not supposed to do that. And you get into a car accident. Is it your fault? Because you didn't have your license? I suggest to you that this is more like a DUI. Parents driving a child in the car, drunk driver hits them. Is that the parent's fault? Do they bear responsibility? No. But what if the parent is the one that is driving drunk? What responsibility then? They've had too much alcohol. They put their kid in the seat. They crash, injure, or kill their child. Is there no responsibility there? I submit to you that there is. And that's the analogy for this case. Responsibility, reckless conduct. In fact, the judge instructed you, reckless homicide. The state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant killed the alleged victim and he acted recklessly. He read to you a definition of recklessly. And I'll reiterate that. Recklessly means that a person acts recklessly when the person is aware of, but consciously disregards, a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the alleged victim will be killed. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that its disregard constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that an ordinary person would exercise under all the circumstances as viewed from the accused person's standpoint. So what do you think? You think that he was aware of a risk that when he fired that gun, the person he shot could be killed?
Walker concluded by saying that Timothy was aware of the risk that when he fired the gun, the person he shot could be killed. She said the state has proven all their aspects of the case. In her closing arguments, defense attorney Joy Kimbrough said that she won't address the felony possession of a handgun charge because, quote, it is what it is. But she said with the remaining counts, she believes the law is on Timothy's side. Don't punish him because he was a felon with a weapon. That charge stands alone, she said. Just because he had a gun at his side on the surveillance video, that does not mean that he was reckless. She said that Tamia snuck inside the home and that Timothy didn't hear her coming in. Tamia was having fun and wanted to scare her father. She jumped out from the side and he shot her, but it wasn't reckless.
That is not reckless. That is not reckless. Listen to this. She just read this. Recklessly means that a person acts recklessly when the person is aware of but consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the alleged victim will be killed. Listen to this when I substitute names into the code. Listen to this. Recklessly means that Timothy acts recklessly when Timothy is aware of, when he is aware of, but consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that Tamia will be killed. At no point is he aware of and consciously disregards that Tamia may be killed. At no point. The law supports him. It supports him. At no point does he think he may be shooting his daughter. At no point. I think it's uncontradicted, it's undisputed, the statement. Nobody thought that he would shoot that little girl. Nobody believes he did it intentionally. Nobody thought that. He loves that little girl. I don't think anybody's going to debate that. He loved that little girl. The law supports this. The law.
She then compared it to former Vice President Dick Cheney's shooting accident.
It reminds me Vice President Dick Cheney. He was out hunting. Thought someone was a deer and shot him. Now he didn't stand trial for it. He didn't stand trial for it because it was an accident. If you look at this, he didn't mean it. He didn't mean it. It was, you know, if you put his name in and the other person, it was out. But part of Mr. Batt's problem, and it's a problem for a lot of people, Mr. Batt started off with a felony. A felony. And when you start off with a felony, it snowballs. You just have problems.
Kimbrough told the jury that Timothy wasn't tampering with the evidence because he only hid the gun. He didn't get rid of it or scratch the serial numbers off. He told the police where it was, and if he wanted to get rid of it, he could have. She implored the jury to do what's right and return a not guilty verdict on the rest of the charges. He once took 6 shots. He's been beat up enough, she said. After the jury deliberated for about 9 hours over 2 days, They returned to the courtroom and announced that they were hung on one of the counts, but were in agreement on the remaining two. They found Timothy guilty of the gun charge, but not guilty of tampering with evidence. And on the biggest charge, reckless homicide, they were hung. Prior to his sentencing, Timothy and the prosecutors entered into a plea agreement on the reckless homicide charge. He would plead guilty in exchange for the recommendation that his sentence for illegally possessing a firearm be served concurrently. At his sentencing on September 1st, 2017, Timothy's defense team showed a video to the court, which included pleas from Timothy's mother, pastor, and friend, who all said that he had turned his life around since his prior drug conviction. Timothy's attorney, Derek Scretchen, asked the judge for a sentence that includes probation, drug treatment, and counseling. Timothy himself then spoke to the court and talked about how he needs to be at home with his family, including his children. "I need them to know that this was a horrible accident. I need to be there so we can rebuild my family and move forward." Judge D. David Gay sentenced Timothy to 4 years in prison. As he was handing down his sentence, he talked about a, quote, trigger-happy video game society full of gun owners who don't know how to use guns. And that's all for this episode. So I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on this case. Do you think Timothy's 4-year sentence was fair? And what did you make about his attorney saying in her closing argument that Timothy shouldn't be punished for having a prior felony conviction? Do you think that those with prior felony convictions are treated unfairly? You can let me know what you think in a number of ways. First, you can join our very active discussion group on Facebook by going to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. I would also like to say a special thank you to today's sponsor, Everlywell. Because let's be real, going to the doctor is terrible. But now you can complete your testing from the comfort of home thanks to Everlywell. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of tests, including food sensitivity, metabolism, and cholesterol, all of which are private, simple, and all processed through certified labs. No more sitting in waiting rooms for hours. Head to everlywell.com and use code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. I also want to remind you guys that going forward, I will now be releasing episodes every 2 weeks instead of weekly. And I also want to remind you that you can get some cool Court Junkie merch like t-shirts, notebooks, phone cases, pillow covers, and more by going to courtjunkie.com/store. And finally, you can access these episodes earlier than everyone else and get them ad-free by going to courtjunkie.com/support. That will direct you to my Patreon page where you can donate as little as $1 a month to get those early ad-free episodes. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Court Junkies.